Well, I feel a bit like I should be wearing a black hat as the guy that spoils all the simple models, but I'm going to tell you about the pesky jets from X-ray binaries. I should also warn you that this is the first time that I've done an electronic presentation, so even though it's rather exciting to be losing my virginity live on the internet, I'm probably going to make a mistake at some point. So, what I'm going to assume, and you'll have to believe me, is that jets are ubiquitous from black hole binaries black hole X-ray binaries when they're in the right state. There are some consequences of this. One is that there's no evidence that there's a population of radio loud and radio quiet X-ray binaries, for example, as you see in AGN, in which you might invoke, for example, the black hole spin to explain this. What I in fact see is that whether or not a source is radio loud is entirely dependent on the X-ray state that it's in. Anne's made very clear that there are persistent and there are transient black hole X-ray binary sources. What I see in the persistent sources is that whenever you're in the hard state, this is the low hard state, which Anne described very clearly, we see very clear evidence for an outflow. Every source which is in this state, I see evidence for an outflow, whether it's persistent or transient. The transient systems on the rise to the peak of their outbursts always show radio emission as well. And in the terms of the persistent sources, we kind of infer the presence from spectral characteristics, although we have imaged jets, at least on one source, Cygnus X1. In these systems, what we actually see is we appear to see discrete ejections of radio-emitting material. And one of the questions that I'm going to see if we can address in this talk is whether or not this is the same jet formation process, or whether you in fact need two jet formation processes going on in these systems. So, the two extremes of the black hole X-ray binary states are the low hard state and the high soft state. The low hard state, as Anne described, seems to have some kind of truncated accretion disk. You certainly don't see the emission from the inner part of a simple Shakira-Sanyaev disk. Probably has some Comptonizing corona and or ADAF, which may or may not be the same thing. In the radio, you always see radio emission, and as I'll show, the spectral characteristics and other properties of this very strongly suggest that in every case where you do see this X-ray state, a jet is present. In the high soft X-ray state, the X-ray spectrum, as Anne described, is well described, at least the first order, by a regular accretion disk coming more or less all the way in, producing a thermal spectrum with a temperature of a few keV. In this state, I do not see jets. So these are the broad properties between the two extremes in the persistent X-ray binary systems. So to give you an example, this is our best example of the behavior of a source in the low hard state, the behavior in X-rays and radio. This is about 3.5 years of daily radio and X-ray monitoring of Cygnus X1. The X-ray data in red, this is the total flux from 2 to 12 keV. The green points are daily radio monitoring at 15 gigahertz performed by Guy Pooley with the Royal Telescope in Cambridge. And what you see with Cygnus X1 is that it kind of burbles up and down with a period of a few months. Until recently, it was fairly clear that the radio emission and X-ray emission kind of correlated even within these burblings quite nicely. When the source goes a little bit higher, it gets a little bit softer. These are the X-ray colors, so ratio of X-ray bands. In both bands, it gets a little bit softer when it gets a little bit brighter. And you can quite clearly see that until recently, it was fairly well correlated, even when it rose. What we've seen in recent months, and I'll come back to shortly, is that when it gets a bit brighter even still, then in fact the radio emission no longer keeps up with the X-rays, but in fact falls off and dies. And this is a very strong clue to the response of the jet in these systems to the presence or absence of the accretion disk component. So this is our nicest data set. This is the kind of thing we see in radio monitoring of these sources. What I've plotted here is soft X-ray flux in approximate Crab units against radio flux in millijanskis at 15 gigahertz with my best correction for guessed distances of sources. This is this should be, to a first order approximation, some kind of ratio to the Eddington accretion rate in these sources, given that, at least compared to AGN, we can more or less assume that these things all have the same mass, these galactic black hole systems. The data that I showed for Cygnus X1, where it correlates, is here. So Cygnus X1 is actually fluctuating over a fairly small range, but there's basically a broad correlation between the X-ray flux and the radio flux in this source. What we see here is 1, 2, 3.5 orders of magnitude in what I would call the low hard state. The key data points here are clearly these red ones, which are data points for the system GX, the low mass binary system GX339-4. Within the error bars, which are obviously increased towards lower fluxes, this is a perfect power law relation between radio and X-ray flux over three orders of magnitude, with an index which makes it close to a linear relation. The points down here are basically what you would call an X-ray black hole X-ray transient in quiescence. In fact, V404 Sig, which is one of the oft-quoted black holes in quiescence, basically sits around here if you put its quiescent radio and X-ray fluxes on. This clearly doesn't line up perfectly with Cygnus X1, but they have the same kind of broad trend in that there's a correlation between radio and X-ray emission. There are other sources which sit very close to a very similar line. Here, the blue triangles, apart from a few outliers, represent the radio and X-ray flux correlations of V404 Sig when it was in outburst in the hard state, and it shows basically the same relation. The transient 1118, when it was in the hard state, sits on the same line here. And there are a few other sources, but basically the spread in the ratio between radio and X-ray fluxes is about one order of magnitude over 3.5 orders of magnitude in radio flux. I would say from this that I really, unless there are some spectral differences, I wouldn't find any reason to say that this wasn't just an extension of the low hard state, even though it's referred to generally as quiescence. One thing this plot will tell you, if you get enough data, is the difference in beaming factors, if there is one, between radio and X-ray emission. If you take the standard assumption, which is that the X-rays in these systems are not beamed and that the radio is, then you should get a spread between different sources based on the inclination angle of the sources. If they have the same beaming factors, which means the jet is not beamed or the X-rays are, then they should all lie pretty much on the same correlation. So the spread that we eventually get when this figure is completed should give some indication in differences in beaming factors between the jet and the X-ray, the source of the X-ray emission. Now, Anne showed the same figure. This is the broadband radio through X-ray spectrum of the hard state transient 1118. Because I'm interested in radio emission, I don't plot nu f nu. Otherwise, the radio emission's down here and doesn't look so important. But this is the broadband spectrum of the source. Anne showed it from about the infrared range, but there's also radio data here. And basically, what we see is that the radio spectrum of the source extends rather neatly onto the infrared band. Detailed modeling by Rob Hines, Anne, and others clearly showed, as she mentioned, that you do need an excess of emission here, given that it links up with the radio emission, and we can be fairly certain the radio emission comes from a jet, then this is pretty much telling us that the jet extends at least to the optical band. If you sum up all the energy in the spectrum, assume that the jet has a radiative efficiency no better than 5%, which seems reasonable for the relativistic jet models and observations of AGN, then at least 10% of all the observed power must already be in the jet. What I'm actually showing here is a fit to the entire broadband radio through X-ray data for this source by Sarah Markov. What I suggested to Sarah and Heino Falke was that maybe we could get some parameters from this jet and see if it could contribute at all to the X-ray band via inverse Comptonization. In fact, what we found, kind of to our surprise, or at least to my surprise, was that you could, if you just take the self-absorbed jet and assume quite naturally that it must break to an optically thin spectrum at some point, this would line up with the X-ray spectrum. So it seems at least vaguely plausible that the X-rays could originate as direct synchrotron emission. But I won't push this point because it's basically heresy. It has been suggested that the spectrum of 1118 was rather exceptional and that we can't really say that, well, whatever you do with 1118 is applicable to other sources. So here's the broadband radio through X-ray spectrum of every source in the hard state for which the data are available. Here's the spectrum of 1118, which I just showed. Here's the spectra. Here's the data for Cygnus X1, our best source, which perhaps could also be different because it's persistent. And there's a variety of other sources which are basically transients or a kind of pseudo-transient, GX339, which have been in the hard X-ray state. In all of these sources, you see a flat or inverted radio spectrum at about the same level in a log flux density plot as the optical emission. And in all these sources, the optical emission is well described by something which breaks and comes down the X-ray band like this. It was even noted as long ago as 1985 by Christian Motsch that it was rather unusual that the X-ray spectrum extends back and links up with the infrared spectrum. In GX339, we actually see a negative spectral component coming in, which if you extrapolate it, basically lines up with the X-ray spectrum. But I said I'm not going to push the point that the X-rays are necessarily associated with the jet, but the point is that the broadband spectra of all of these sources in the X-ray hard state are very similar. Seeing is believing. Well, this is an image, this is a VLBA image of Cygnus X1 in the radio band, and we clearly resolve a jet from this source. We've observed it 6 times now with VLBI, and every time we resolve a jet. As I've said, you see pretty much the same radio X-ray correlation, you see pretty much the same broadband spectrum in all of these low hard state sources. So I would say, well, at least to me, a very clear conclusion is that basically there is a very powerful jet in all low hard state sources, whether they be transient or persistent. Now in Cygnus X1, as I showed in the plot of the daily monitoring, in recent days, the source has been getting ever brighter in its flaring episodes, and the radio emission has failed to keep up with this. And what you see, if I plot X-ray against radio flux for this source, is that indeed it correlates for a bit, and at some critical point, the radio emission fails to keep up and actually turns over, and most of these points below about here are actually upper limits to the radio flux from this source. I've been kind of guilty in the past of quantizing the X-ray states in these things, like a lot of other people do, saying that there's low hard states, there's just discrete states. As Mike Nowak pointed out, I mean, really, this is a continuum. Over a factor of about 2 or 3 in Cygnus X1, the soft component becomes more important. The spectrum softens, these are the X-ray colors, and the radio emission correlates for a bit and then is basically killed. There was also evidence from Stefan Korbel that in what he called an intermediate state in that source, the radio emission was off as well. So this is basically telling you that a soft component kills the jet. This was a kind of uncertainty about this intermediate states, which also show hard X-ray emission. But it's very clear now that basically when the soft component of the disk comes in, the jet is killed. The question is whether or not the jet is physically suppressed, i.e. it's mechanically, it's not made, whatever the physical process is that makes a jet doesn't occur when the disk comes in, or whether it's Compton cooled by all the soft photons in the inner disk. So if I show the same figure that I showed a bit of before and extend it up to approaching the Eddington limit, again, we see this correlation in the low hard state sources, and we see in Cygnus X1 that as you approach, that our best guess is that this is around a few percent of Eddington. So you go along through 3 orders of magnitude in the low hard state. As you approach the Eddington limit, the radio emission is killed. The jet is killed in these nice disk solutions. I show up here data for Cygnus X3, which admittedly is a rather unusual and poorly understood object, but it is one for which we also have the daily radio and X-ray monitoring. And again, in that source, you see a hint of the same behavior. You see a correlation at relatively low values for the spread of data for this source. And at higher X-ray fluxes, it drops off. Except, of course, it also flares in Cygnus X3. And yeah, I mean, I really can't explain this. But you see a similar pattern of behavior, at least in this part of the diagram. This same process of soft X-ray component, which we interpret as the disk killing the jet, is observed in a variety of different sources on a variety of different timescales. This used to be my favorite plot for illustrating it. This is a GX339. This is about 2 years of daily radio and X-ray monitoring of the source. It was going along in the hard state, showed radio emission, hard X-ray emission. It then spent a year in the soft X-ray state, and the radio emission was completely suppressed for the entire year. We didn't detect a single fraction of a millijansky from the source for an entire year. It returned to a hard state, and the radio emission came back on, along with the hard X-rays. So this was this killing of the jet process happening on timescales of a year. In GRS 1915, and I would have advised you to look at the poster of Mark Kleinwalt, but it's already been removed. But his paper is published, or soon. What we see in GRS 1915 is transitions to a hard state on timescales of 20 minutes or so, very rapid cycles. So the blue here indicates hard states, yellow and red are soft states. And we're very confident that each one of these dips is associated with a small radio event, and that each one of these radio events is transient production of the jet. And that basically when the disk comes back in, the radio jet is killed, just as it's killed on year timescales in GX339-4 and on timescales of days in Cygnus X1. The bottom panel here, incidentally, are fits to the X-ray spectrum, the inner disk radius. You shouldn't necessarily believe the numbers, but perhaps the trend is believable, which is basically that during these dips, the inner disk recedes for these spectral fits to a radius of about 200 kilometers and refills. And it's this refilling which is associated with the suppression of the jet. Okay, so going on to the X-ray transients, I've discussed the spectral states of the persistent sources. The X-ray transients seem to go from some kind of off X-ray state to, in most cases, a soft state. This soft state is either the high soft state or the very high state. Some of them end up in a low hard state. All of them, certainly in the case of the black hole transients, go through a phase of producing optically thin ejections associated with this rise. Just to show some images for people who haven't seen these jets from X-ray binaries before. These are recent images that we made last year of the well-known source GRS 1915 plus 105, and this is another sequence of ejections that we see from the source at apparent velocities of 2 or 3C, depending on your best guess of the distance to the source, which means, of course, that they're highly relativistic ejections. These are associated. This source is very nice. It does this thing for us every few months, and each one of these is associated with an X-ray outburst. This is the kind of thing we see from transients. And at least five of these five different sources, we have now directly resolved this kind of outflow. So as I say, there's dramatic and X-ray, a dramatic X-ray and radio outburst, usually resulting in a soft state from these sources. The radio emission always occurs associated with these events. There's actually published data for 16 different X-ray black hole X-ray transients. 15 of the 16 were detected as bright radio sources. So given that the vagaries of observing, this basically is consistent with all of them. The radio emission, as I say, is often resolved into apparently discrete ejections. And this implication is therefore that a transient powerful jet is formed during a brief phase when it's going from off to soft. So we've seen that a black hole undergoing steady diskless low hard states produces a steady jet. The steady jet has characteristic correlation with the X-rays, has a characteristic spectral contribution, and has been directly imaged in the case of Cygnus X1. Is the jet formation mechanism different for transients? This is what I think is a fairly important question. If the answer is yes, then basically we require two physical processes for launching a relativistic jet, possibly one operating at high accretion rates with an inner disk present. If no, then given that the jets we see in the persistent sources are associated with hard states, then presumably these transients should display a brief hard flare during rise to outburst in each case. If they really just go from a very weak hard state to a very soft state, getting gradually softer, then this would be kind of inconsistent with this model. Well, Catherine Broxop just published a paper where she compiles the data on all of these soft X-ray transient sources and concludes that there is no X-ray transient where you can be sure that you did not have a hard X-ray spike in the rise to outburst. And I'll just show one of the light curves. This is a light curve for the X-ray transient J1859 plus 226, a 60-day period. The solid line is hard X-ray emission, as observed with BATSE. The big dots are radio emission observed with a variety of radio telescopes, and the small dots are soft X-ray emission from XT All Sky Monitor. So first of all, you clearly see an outburst in all three energy bands. This is the hard X-ray spike that Catherine would argue is present, possibly present in all soft X-ray transient outbursts. And therefore, you might make a nice causal connection between this hard X-ray spike, if it is ubiquitous, and the radio emission. I showed this one also because you have to be kind of fair and look at it and say, well, in fact, that's a nice argument, but it actually seems to me, at least, that the radio emission is correlated more with the soft X-ray spike. So I think the jury is really still out on this. You have to be honest about it. Nevertheless, the hard X-ray spike does seem to be a generic property of all these soft X-ray transient outbursts. So this is the full diagram of X-ray against radio flux for all the sources that I managed to compile in a week before I came to this meeting. There are no doubt some errors associated with distances and corrections for NH, etc. Nevertheless, you can probably say that within a factor of a few, this is right for all sources. And this, as I said before, this is about the Eddington luminosity for pretty much all these sources, since they're all about the same mass. So the general picture I see for these black hole sources is that between 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 of Eddington, and 10 to the minus 1 of Eddington, they produce a steady jet which is correlated with the X-ray flux. And if the X-ray flux is correlated with the mass accretion rate, then so is the jet power. In the small region of parameter space, it seems that I've learnt this week, where you make a nice, steady, thin disk, the jet is suppressed. The jet is killed when you have a soft disk component in. The points here represent GRS 1915, which is this very dramatic source for which we directly resolve the relativistic ejections. And in this source, well, for a start, it always seems to be at or above the Eddington limit. And the relation between the radio and X-ray emission is very erratic. It's kind of like this upper branch to Cygnus X3. It has been suggested to me, although I'm not smart enough to work it out whether it's correct or not, and I haven't had time to think about it anyway, that this is the low accretion rate ADAF solution, which is associated with a jet. This is the disk solution, which can't make a jet. And up here, you're at the very high mass accretion rate ADAF solution, which again supports a jet. So I just briefly want to mention something about neutron star X-ray binaries and their associated radio emission. The neutron star X-ray binaries can be broadly separated into three classes. There are the X-ray pulsars, which are believed to have high dipole fields, 10 to the 12 Gauss or so. Then there are the rest, which are believed to have dipole fields less than 10 to the 10 Gauss or so, which shouldn't really affect the accretion flow, accretion disk, very dramatically. That is their magnetic fields. The Z sources are the six brightest neutron star sources in our galaxy. So these things are supposed to be accreting at a large fraction of the Eddington rate. Six of them in our galaxy. The prototype is SCOEX one. Very naively and broad in a broad brush manner, I characterize all the rest of the sources as atolls. These are relatively low surface field sources accreting at much lower accretion rates. And this probably includes the class of neutron star X-ray transients. The X-ray pulsars, as I've said, they have a high surface magnetic field. Observational evidence and pretty reliable theory says that this magnetic field should disrupt the disk at rather large distances from the accreting object, so distances more than 1,000 kilometers or so. None of these sources have ever been observed as radio synchrotron sources. In fact, this is pretty much the only class of the diverse classes of X-ray binaries which have never shown radio emission. This includes persistent X-ray pulsars and transient X-ray pulsars. The Z sources show this characteristic pattern in the X-ray color diagram, where mass accretion rate is believed to go this way. This state is a little bit harder, shows a little bit more variability. This state appears to be the one which is associated with the strongest radio emission. The data are nowhere near as good for these sources as they are for the black hole systems. Nevertheless, it seems fairly reliable that this is the case. In the atoll sources, these sources are more or less hardest and supposedly at the lowest mass accretion rates when they're on the intermediate state. How's it going for time? Okay. We have even less data for the atoll sources, but it does seem from the small amount of data that we do have that, again, the radio emission is on when you would infer that the accretion rate is at its lowest. So similar patterns are existing between the black holes and the neutron stars in that the hard states at the lowest inferred accretion rates, and something which I'm not going to discuss, but also with the strongest variability in both the neutron stars and black holes, are associated with radio emission. And the point that you have no radio synchrotron emission from any X-ray pulsar presumably is telling us that we at least need an inner disk region within some region to produce the jet. Also, you don't even need to be a black hole to make a relativistic jet. It might be easy to forget this point. In fact, there was something being proposed a few years ago, which was that the velocity of jets from sources somehow reflected the escape velocity of the systems, in which case the neutron stars should be producing jets of about 0.3c, and only AGN and galactic black holes would produce the truly relativistic jets. Well, there are two examples here of sources which are clearly established to be neutron stars. This one is SCOEX-1. This is one of a sequence of many radio images by Ed Fomalhaut, where they measure two pattern speeds. They measure a speed of communication of energy from here to radio lobes, and also proper motions of the radio lobes themselves. And they can fairly unambiguously establish that there's a flow with a bulk Lorentz factor of more than at least 3 in this source. So this is way above 0.9c. These are recent observations of ours, a sequence of observations of the X-ray binary Cirrus-Sinus X1, now on much larger scales, on arc-second scales. And again, we find what may be a similar pattern of physics. However, we can infer much more extreme parameters because the angle to the line of sight is very small in this source, or so we infer. We can infer that we have a bulk Lorentz factor, at least of communication of signals, of more than 15 in this source, and this is a neutron star. There is one thing which we found. They're not identical in their relation between their X-ray and radio properties. Neutron stars are not as radio loud as black holes. What I show here is a histogram of weak definition of radio loudness for these sources, which is basically Millijansky's divided by Crab, the radio to the X-ray band. The histogram shows points for transient systems. So there are transient outbursts also associated with the neutron stars, although I should confess that none of them has been resolved into a jet yet. These are the black hole systems. These two distributions are statistically different. The black holes are more radio loud by a factor of between 3 and 30 than the neutron stars. The arrows that I've placed here indicate my best impression of the ratio of radio to X-ray flux for the persistent sources. And again, the factor between the two is about the same. So what does this tell us? Well, maybe it's evidence for black hole event horizons. This would be one interpretation, which I'm sure would be very popular with the press offices. If this were correct, in which I'm saying that basically the black holes, you don't see all of the X-ray emission, and if you did, this would be shifted to the left a bit. If that's correct, that means you must have ADAF solutions at high accretion rates, because we're talking about transient outbursts here. Or maybe the black holes are simply more efficient at making jets. Maybe they really are extracting the black hole spin, for example. One intriguing possibility, which is very nice, is that for the two neutron star sources I just showed, SCOEX-1 and Cirrus-Sinus X1, we have characteristic frequencies in the power spectrum, which would give you a fairly good guess at what the spin frequency of these sources are. Given that you also know the mass of a neutron star and have a fairly good idea of the radius, you can really directly estimate how much spin energy you could extract from the neutron stars. And they also have the additional benefit that you can't really lose any energy across an event horizon. So you can really measure the energy budget of the jet as a fraction of the total in these sources. So to conclude, again early, the low-hard X-ray state always produces a powerful jet over at least 3 orders of magnitude in the X-ray luminosity, and in a similar way in all black holes, whether they're persistent or transient. States with a strong disk component progressively suppress the jet, killing it within a factor of few in the X-ray flux. So this really supports the idea that something very critical happens at some mass accretion rate or X-ray luminosity. Transient outbursts follow a similar radio X-ray correlation. They sit more or less on the same line in this diagram that I showed, but they're at a much higher accretion rate. An important question is the jet physics the same? Is it the same mechanism producing the jet? Or maybe it's just the emission physics which is the same. Somehow one of the two components is acting as a thermostat for the other. And finally, it's an important point and a very fruitful avenue of research, I think, to look at the jets from the neutron stars, because it seems they can do all the same tricks as the black holes, but they will allow us to measure much more confidently things like the relation between the total accretion budget and the neutron star spin, etc. Thank you.
Direct way to determine whether those jets emit X-rays, and I think this is by correlating X-rays and radio. I mean, what you show ASN on daytime scale, but you know, this is at a long time scale, and we know that X-ray emission has far spectra extending to, you know, hundreds of hertz, millisecond variability, and then in fact for say Sigma 6-1 there is more plenty of PCA observations. So if you could say, you could take simultaneous PCA radio and make a cross correlation, or you can just plot the power spectrum of your radio and see whether your power spectrum extends to 700 hertz or something like that.
The problem is that unless this is a coherent radio emission process, this will be impossible because the radio emitting volume is too large. It acts as a high frequency filter.
Yes,
it will be impossible.
The radio emitting volume.
The radio emitting. Oh, I'm sorry. If you had the impression that I was saying this is wrong. They come from the same jet, but the X-rays come from a much smaller region than the radio. Of course, you have progressive photospheres, basically.
Well, so then when it's not so different from just this distance.
Well, the emission process is completely different.
I have two basic questions. I guess we're a little early, so I'll ask two questions. This isn't my field, so I apologize for their basic nature. But the first and last paper I read on the radio jet of 1915 was the original Mirabella and Rodriguez. And that was like God's gift to teaching special relativity, because if you assume the pattern speed was the same as the bulk speed, then you were overdetermined, and you could, and you know, we knew that Einstein was right and so on. Has it behaved that way since then? Can you rationalize that the pattern speed and the bulk speed are the same?
GRS 1915 has behaved qualitatively the same. Quantitatively, the proper motions we get at higher radio resolution are higher than the original VLA observations. But quantitatively, the pattern is the same. The argument that the bulk speeds were the same as the pattern speeds came from getting your estimate of the pattern speeds from directly from the observations, and then taking the ratio from the Doppler boosting. And within a factor of a few, they are what you would expect if it's bulk motion. That's correct.
Like a factor of a few spread.
Yeah.
Okay, and my other question is, these orbital sizes, if measured in, say, RG, does it matter how big the orbits are in terms of the properties of the jets?
Orbits of what?
These are all binaries.
Oh, no. No.
Doesn't matter if the orbits are 100 RG or a million RG.
They're way bigger than this. They're way bigger than this. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, say that again?
They're much, much bigger than this.
They're much bigger than that, and it doesn't affect the jet properties, whether they're...
It might affect them a little bit, but basically the patterns of correlation I showed range from sources with hours to days, binary periods, so it's not affecting it that much.
Greg, I think
you're right. The radio emission in the neutron stars, the radio emission from the jet, is it really non-thermal, or there is any indication it might be thermal emission?
It's definitely non-thermal. We have spectrum polarization.
Okay.
During a radio outburst? Well, the...
High-frequency
QPOs. It's very hard to say in the high X-ray states exactly when the radio emission is produced. So the only one that I can confidently directly associate is the low-hard state, which has a lot of noise and some low-frequency QPOs. High-frequency, I think it would be hard to say. But Ron wants to say something.
In general, when we see high frequency QPOs, there is a substantial disk, and if there's any radio flux, the suspicion it's decoupled by a jet that's evolving and left town days ago.
Absolutely.
And we're now very consistent with what Rob was saying. When you see a lot of disk flux,
you don't see the radio, and when you see a lot of disk flux, the probability of seeing a high-frequency QPO is much higher.
Be it from starting from Blanchard Kernighan model or any reasonable geometric scaling of the jet, you can show that there's actually nonlinear scaling with the black hole with the compact object mass.
Okay.
Saying that if you have higher mass, you would expect more radio. So in that sense, there should be a trend to be observed with higher mass being more radio loud, and that might be consistent at least with what's observed for the difference between neutron stars and black holes. That scaling should fall somewhere between 1.5 and 2.
Okay. That's a good point, yep.
Could you say a little bit more about the observation?
No. We're live on the internet. I can't do it. I'll tell you later.
That's the best answer to
that. Measuring jet kinetic powers is always kind of a dicey business, but are there any sorts of bounds you can put on these?
No, not really. The estimates I have, for example, of the radiative efficiency of the jet, these are about 5%, and these are assuming no kinetic energy component at all. This is just for the acceleration of the particles. If I start adding in kinetic energy, then your energy budget just gets worse and worse. I mean, it's pretty large. For the repeated events that we see in JURIS 1915, if I have them moving at something like the same speed that we see these major ejection events, which we directly resolve, and then we see these radio oscillation events, which we don't resolve spatially. But if I associate, if I say that each one of these events is moving out with the same kind of velocities we see for the big ejections, I do the minimum energy, get the total number of electrons, add a proton, just a cold proton, to each electron, and then the total energy is ridiculous. It's really high. Okay, so you should look at the paper, but I think it's more than 10 to the 40 Hz per second going into the jet. In the case of 1915 sequence we saw, this would be continuously for several days, every 20 minutes.
Roger. For the GX329-4 data, that you showed this nice correlation, and at the low fluxes, it might be a little ratty, but that could be that at those very, very low fluxes, when practically in quiescence, the flux of 329-4 is changing by factors of many on the timescales of just a few days. So given the synchrotron lifetimes, there could be a decoupling.
Oh, I'm sorry, you meant that it wasn't quite on the straight line at the bottom?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so low in,
exactly,
in flux. Within the error bars, it is actually.
But even if you can measure it very well, that the flux is changing so much in a time scale of a few days, and given the synchrotron lifetimes, that there could be a decoupling from what you observe in the X-rays and what you observe in the radio, such that it could be perfectly consistent that it's linear all the way down to quiescence. So given that there is this nice, pretty much one-to-one correlation between X-ray and radio, all the way from where it goes into the hard state, all the way into quiescence, and this is the question for Roger. Would you expect that from Matios or not?
The answer could be no. I don't think we have any good prescriptive way of describing the mass output of one of these solutions. I mean, that's one of the problems that I emphasized was, unless you would observe the physics on this disk, you have no special way of identifying the mass output with the radius of the disk or the frequency output, you need to do an explicit question of radius that you can do in the sun. So the answer to that question is no, I have no magic bullet.
One of the few simple problems is that you get jets at very low frequencies, very high frequencies.
What I would say is that we found that we don't get jets in a narrow range, in fact.
Don't get jets.
Right.
And when Alex gave his talk yesterday, he showed that the two spectrum are quite similar in the sense that they both have big geometrical
yeah.
Big flows. And so I was
I agree.
Is there any more evidence that it is a neutron star besides the that?
Yeah, well,
presumed X-ray burst 100 years ago.
Yeah, this is exactly the point. What Dimitrios is talking about is this neutron star source, Sirius Sinus X1, which I said had a gamma 15 flow. The reason it's identified as a neutron star source is because 20 years ago or something, Exosat saw some X-ray bursts from it. But this had a large field of view, and it is in the galactic plane. So it's not certain. On the other hand, the timing and color diagram properties are a bit more like a neutron star than a black hole, but that's open for debate. But SCO X1 is definitely a neutron star. Which? This is also true, actually. No? Yeah. No, you're quite right. You're quite right. We don't even know the Z sources are neutron stars, actually. I think most people who work on timing would say it's definitely a neutron star, but that's not proof.
Are jets always optic during the low hot state?
Up to at least the infrared band, yeah. Yeah. Well, you take a self-similar outflow, then it will be self-absorbed. It will produce this characteristic flat spectrum in a simple isothermal case. Yeah.